You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
It doesn't seem too bad. Your pet just seems a bit off. You've been watching it for the past day or two, and you just aren't sure if it's serious or not. Now it's 7 p.m. You just got home from work, and your regular veterinarian is closed for the day, and your pet looks terrible. What to do? Dr. Mike Walters is all too familiar with the previous scenario. He is board certified in veterinary emergency and critical care. He practices in Southern California at dedicated veterinary care in Tustin. We will learn about simple preventive steps you can take to keep your pet out of the ER and when you should and shouldn't practice. Ready, set, wait. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Petco, where the pets go. Petco, where the pets go.
Pet Life Radio has tail wagging, fur flying, fabulous deals for our listeners from Petco. Get $6 off your order of $60 or more, and up to 40% off the entire Petco site.
That's right.
But that's not all.
Because you're a Pet Life Radio listener, you'll also get free shipping on your order of $49 or more. $6 off, up to 40% off,
and free shipping
from Pet Life Radio and Petco. To get these awesome deals, go to PetcoDeals.com. That's PetcoDeals.com.
Petco, where the pets go.
I'm not much of a reader, but I do wish I were more well-read.
There are so many great books coming out. I wish I could find a way to keep up.
Audible.com makes it easy to stay well informed and catch up on your reading simply by listening. Audiobooks from Audible turn downtime into uptime. You'll be more productive and become well-read.
Now I'm able to catch up on all the great books I've been wanting to read.
With Audible, I feel smarter.
Pet Life Radio listeners, try Audible.com now and get your first 30 days of Audible Listener Gold Membership plan free. And get a free audiobook. Choose from over 100,000 titles. To get this great deal, go to audibledeals.com. That's audibledeals.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Mike, I know you see a lot of emergencies, and I actually will send clients from my practice over to you when I have a critical case, something that needs to be watched by someone with you with all that expertise. What's your training that's different from what most general practitioners get? Because I love having you there as my backup.
And we appreciate you sending cases. That's certainly, again, appreciated. So my training in background is not unlike yours, with 4 years of veterinary school and an internship following that. And then in most cases, people who go on to do residencies do it soon after their internship. In my case, I had a bit of a lag of several years before going on to a residency, which is, in my case, was a 3-year program at Colorado State University, and got my training in emergency critical care. And then following that residency, then there's a fairly rigorous exam that you have to take and pass. And then at that point, you're, you know, deemed a diplomate of the American College of Veterinary Emergency and Critical Care. So, you know, it's a long haul, but with my background, I understand where the generalists are coming from. I've practiced in general practice before. I've practiced emergency after hours, and now doing, you know, daytime critical care and emergency. So I have a pretty diverse background.
And there are times when the majority of the cases they'll be walking through my doors are going to be maybe the vomiting, maybe the diarrhea, something's going on for a while, sometimes congestive heart failure, a myriad of things. But there are times when, yes, in the middle of the night, you need an emergency hospital. But there are also times when you need the criticalist. This is the pet that is not going to survive unless they have, people might be familiar with a CCU, a critical care unit, or an ICU. And that's exactly what you're doing. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's a good analogy. You know, our practice, unlike similar sort of 24-hour specialty practices, is essentially like a human critical care unit or intensive care unit. We have all the equipment, the ability to deliver oxygen. We have mechanical ventilators. We have on-site labs. We have digital radiography. In our case, we have, you know, other sort of bells and whistles that we use on a fairly regular basis to help manage and care for these critically ill pets. So a little bit different. There's a lot of things that sit on the shelf and don't get used that often, but when you need it, you need it, and it's there. And of course, our biggest asset is our staff. We have, you know, wonderful nursing staff that are, in many cases at our practice, have gone on and taken their own specialty board exam. So we have specialized nursing. And then our doctor staff is also very well experienced in emergency medicine. And then, you know, having me on board as sort of backup when I'm not there, I feel very comfortable with my staff managing these cases. And if they have questions, then, you know, they can always, you know, call me in, you know, whatever needs to be done to help care for that patient.
How common are criticalists throughout the United States? I know I'm very fortunate here in Southern California to have several, but I have this distinct feeling that you guys aren't everywhere.
I think we tend to concentrate where the cases are. So that's large metropolitan areas. So it's going to be hard to find one in the middle of, you know, Wyoming or something like that. But there are quite a few. My guess would be we're one of the fastest growing sort of specialty colleges out there. I don't know the exact numbers, but there are a fairly large number of individuals who are in residency programs right now, you know, anticipating coming out and graduating and taking those specialty exams. And I don't know the numbers offhand as far as the actual numbers of criticalists that are boarded out there, but I would say it's easily in the, you know, the hundreds right now. So there are a number of us out there, and we do tend to concentrate in sort of large metropolitan areas because that's where people live and that's where the pets are.
I think one of the things that the listeners should realize that even if they are living in some place like Wyoming, Montana, Iowa, Central California, where there is not a criticalist, their primary care veterinarian can still do amazing things. I know
exactly.
Before we had criticalists here in Southern California, I was in a practice where we would have pets literally on a respirator all night and somebody, a technician, a doctor there, keeping it breathing, keeping it going. So miracles can still happen without a criticalist, but when someone like yourself is available, boy, it is a godsend. It is wonderful.
And, you know, the great thing about, I think, about our profession is that we are sort of the jacks of many trades and masters of many in some ways. And yes, there's people out there who are internists and surgeons and criticalists and dermatologists and all that, and that's great. I think that's very useful, and that's what I like to do. But the generalists also have a very good background in many cases. And as you described, I can remember myself, you know, I'm in northern Arkansas in one of my first jobs and having a patient who needed somebody to stay there, and that's you. And you just stayed there and you did what needed to be done, and you kind of cobbled together things and you did a little bit of MacGyvering you know, you got the patient through. And I think owners understand that you're trying. You know, you're drawing on your knowledge and your experience, and maybe you're calling a friend or, you know, doing something to help kind of pull in as many minds as you can, even if you are in the middle of nowhere, so to speak. And that's the same with these referral centers around. You know, I on occasion will still get calls sort of randomly from people who don't have specialists nearby but just need, you know, to run something by them, you know, and we're always available for that, for those types of questions. That's part of the job description.
Well, I am sure that you see a myriad of cases walking through the door day and night. What are some of the most common emergencies that you and your staff see?
So by far and away, the most common, I think, would be the GI upset, the vomiting and or diarrhea, dog or cat. And, you know, in most cases, it's fairly simple. As you've probably seen in the past, it's the dog or cat who eats something out of the ordinary food-wise or maybe gets into the trash or something like that. But then still, it's still a matter of trying to decide, is this something fairly simple or is it something a little bit more complex like they ate a sock? And so that's probably the second most common, is eating things that are not going to pass and not going to cause some huge problems. So that's probably the most common. And we see a fair number of trauma cases. We see a fair number of intoxications of a variety, whether it's, you know, human over-the-counter medications or human prescription drugs or maybe even veterinary prescription drugs that, you know, got accidentally left out and, you know, a small dog ingests a big dog's dose of whatever. And then there's the more serious intoxications, the antifreeze, xylitol gums, the sugar-free gums can be very serious. So those are some fairly common ones that we see. And then, of course, the referral cases can be all over the map. Like you described, heart failure case, liver failure, kidney failure, complex metabolic and endocrine cases. So it's, but from an emergency standpoint, I would think the GI cases are the most common.
Dr. Walters, you brought up intoxications, and there are times I haven't done it for a while, but worked emergency, and I've still even had it come in recently. Pet comes in, typically a dog, because dogs love to explore their environment by sticking things in their mouth first and swallowing, and then maybe going, you know, maybe I shouldn't have eaten that shoe or the sock or the hair scrunchie or whatever it ate. But people will bring in their pet going, gee, I have no idea why it seems kind of spacey and it's a little bit wobbly on its feet. It's ataxic. Gee, I have no idea. And you're looking at this and they may or may not be youngish because it can happen to various age groups. But it's marijuana ingestion. And people are so hesitant to say, oh, it got into my stash, or maybe it's even medical marijuana and they get into. So one of the things I've told people, I'm not the police. I'm not going to call the police. I don't care. I just need to know, what did your pet get into? And it's like, oh, it got into some marijuana. I said, all right. And sometimes they think it's fun. You know, they're blowing it into their face or they're giving them some of their cookies, whatever. And now the pet is really having a difficult time. Tell us about the whys, wherefores, and problems associated with these drugs, such as marijuana.
So, and I agree, we see the same thing, and I approach it exactly as you described, as far as trying to get the client to sort of admit what maybe this pet has gotten into. And sometimes they won't. And so, you know, there are some tests that can be done that will help guide you. There are some of the human urine tests that we use on occasion. We have to be a little careful with reading those because they are a human product and dogs and cats, of course, metabolize things differently. So you can have some sort of false positives and maybe even false negative results. But in some cases, you just don't know and you just have to go with what are the clinical signs. You know, is the heart rate very low? Are the pupils pinpoint? Are, you know, what are the physiologic changes that you're seeing, and then you just end up managing those signs. Certainly have to sometimes fall back on other diagnostics and look at routine things like kidney function, liver function, electrolytes. In some ways, you just don't know. We, you know, kind of refer to it as the dog got into some kind of toxin, and you just have to just manage what you have in front of you.
Supportive care.
If the client won't admit, you know, yes, he got pot or he got something else.
So when in doubt, take your pet in, be honest. The veterinarian's not going to be playing the cop, just really needs to help your pet. That's our concern.
Yeah, exactly. We don't accuse, we don't point fingers. You know, things happen, you know, accidents happen. And maybe it's not really an accident in some cases, and maybe you learned your lesson. But, you know, our interest and focus is the pet. We're not, as you pointed out, we're not going to call the police or anything like that. Just tell us what happened, what may have happened, what could have happened, you know, the party, whatever, and just let us know that, you know, this is possible, and then we can kind of work it from there.
Speaking of parties, you and I are doing this interview in the nice hot part here in Southern California, summer. And during the summer, it seems like there's so many more, at least we seem to get so many more accidental poisonings, situations that people are home with their pets or vacationing with their pets and they're getting into trouble. What are some of the summer seasonal problems that you're seeing?
So certainly the number one problem is overheating. You know, remember that your pets, particularly dogs, and on a rare occasion cats, but dogs can't perspire. They have to exchange their heat through their lungs, and so that's what panting is all about. They oftentimes have heavy coats of hair, and they just can't tolerate, you know, some of the very hot temperatures that we're experiencing this summer.
And even shaving them down doesn't seem to help either.
Yeah.
People oftentimes will shave them down.
Shaving them down, and you see a lot of, you know, the heavy-coated dogs shaved down still having, you know, overheating or heat stroke type problems.
And then get the sunburn too.
And then you got the opposite end, exactly. So it's a matter of just being sort of cognizant of, hey, you know, my dog is getting a little too hot. It's, you know, a little bit too much activity. Time to take a break. Plenty of fresh water. Shade to put the dog in to help kind of, you know, alleviate some of that. Put him inside. You know, get him out of the heat. And if they happen to get overheated, cooling them down, you know, whether it's a hose, whether it's, you know, a quick dip in the ocean or something like that, just to help cool them may be beneficial. And if it's really serious and they're, you know, very concerned, then they need to see their veterinarian or an emergency center.
What are the signs that you see these animals presenting with? Because oftentimes, yes, you'll see the panting and going, well, they pant anyway. And, you know, people will be amazed and going, but why didn't it stop? You know, I'm on my bicycle and I'm going along and finally it just collapsed. Where did that come from? It's like, duh, you're not watching.
Yeah.
So what should they look for? What signs besides just the panting should they be aware of?
So respiratory distress, which again takes some ability to kind of recognize in some cases, where they seem to be laboring to breathe. Maybe deep red mucous membranes, their gums. You know, if they're very deep and injected in appearance, that might be an early indication. If they're weak and wobbly, you know, that might be an indication. If they've had vomiting or maybe even some diarrhea, perhaps with blood in either of those, that may be certainly a big sign that something's, you know, very drastically going wrong. You know, unfortunately, it's a matter of we're, as pet owners, sometimes not very aware because we're just sort of caught in the moment. And we think, oh, our old dog can go out and do these things because we can, and they're just not accustomed to it or not really tailored to it. They're not built for it.
You were talking about the exchanging of heat. I don't know, everyone else is probably experiencing their own summer, but here in Southern California right now, it's been so humid. And that really seems to make losing that heat even more difficult. So if you have that fat pet, young pet, that pug-nosed face dog like the bulldog, all of these things with that added humidity just adds even more insult to injury, making it so much more imperative that you're watching these kids.
Exactly. Particularly the dogs that already have what you might describe as the compromised airway to begin with, the pug-nosed dogs, the English bulldogs, pugs, French bulldogs, they have the same structure as a long-nosed dog smushed into a much smaller space. So, and we've all, those who have them, I have my own Frenchie, know that, you know, even on a good day, they make a lot of noise breathing. Well, you couple that with hot temperatures and, as you described, the humidity that we recently have, they can't exchange that heat very well, and they could easily get into an overheating problem. So even with, you know, fairly mild exercise where they previously, hey, they did that just great, I'm just going to go on my usual walk, and all of a sudden the weather's changed, it's a little bit more humid. Now the environmental changes have made it, you know, harder for that already compromised airway dog to exchange heat, and they can get into a bad situation very quickly.
You're talking about going for a walk. I love walking barefoot, so there are times I'll go outside and think, ouch, you know, and immediately have to run back in and put some sandals on. People so many times are shocked when they'll bring in a dog and it has, you know, it's a lameness. Going, why is it lame? And you flip its little paws over and these poor kids have blisters on their pads. And, well, I didn't know it was so hot. And my usual smart remark is, okay, take your shoes off, stand on the concrete or the asphalt. And if you can stand there comfortably, then it's okay for your pet. But if it's too hot for you, it's too hot for your pet. Do it another time of day or walk on grass or dirt. Your views on what they should do for trying to tell if the temperature is too hot?
I think those are great ideas. You know, unfortunately, even though the temperature may be fairly mild, that sun beating down on the asphalt and on the concrete, it concentrates that heat really well. And so you're right. You know, if it's uncomfortable for you to walk barefoot, then it's going to be very uncomfortable for your dogs to walk on that sort of surface. So, like you described, change your walk time. Go on a different surface. Take them to the beach trail. Take them to, you know, a dog park or something like that where it may be a little bit more comfortable for them. And then still keeping in your mind that those, as that day progresses, it's going to get warmer and warmer, so they're going to easily get overheated if you're not careful.
Well, one of the things I do love about the heat and the summer are all the plants that are blooming in my backyard, and I have lots of bees back there. And thankfully, my two cats that are allowed in the backyard when I'm home to watch them have not started playing with the bees. But I've had a dog the other day that came in the middle of an anaphylactic shock situation because of a bee sting, and thankfully, that's not common. I would love to have you address insect stings, the more common things that will be seen, and then the worst case scenarios.
So, yes, we see a fair number of insect stings, or just somewhat unknown, hey, I'm not sure what happened, my dog's face or limb is swollen, or maybe they have hives, you know, they're having that, you know, early hypersensitivity sort of reaction. So at home, you know, if you're, again, observant, you might be able to say, oh, yes, you know, I saw them playing with a bee and he got stung and now that's why his face is swollen. That's what happens in my house. I typically recommend that owners try to contact their referring vet or an emergency center and get some instruction. It's probably best to ask that question about dosing. You know, everybody probably has drugs like Benadryl or similar drugs at home that could be used in an emergency. But then it's the matter of, well, is that going to just be the extent of it? Is it just going to be the little bit swollen face and maybe they're a little itchy? Or is it going to get worse? So I think my bottom line recommendation is overall, if there is some sort of allergic reaction, it's probably best that your veterinarian see it. Because as you described in your anaphylactic sort of reaction, it can progress and it can progress unpredictably. And certainly the anaphylactic or anaphylactoid reaction is the extreme, where the dog or cat goes into a shock-like syndrome and their blood pressure drops and they're in very serious situations. Those are rare, but not, you know, uncommon. And so you just have to, you know, err on the side of caution. And that's why I think it's probably best that you at least have a pet seen by your family vet, just to make sure that, hey, it is a fairly simple thing. Here's some Benadryl. Maybe here's a little bit of a short-acting steroid. Here's some other medications. Here's some things to look out for and keep an eye on. And then, you know, of course, then the vet can also make the assessment that, oh, this is a little bit more serious. Maybe we need to be a little bit more aggressive.
And it can happen so quickly. Thankfully, this particular owner saw the bee sting happen in a rear paw, but by the time they made it from their home to my practice, it probably was 10, 15 minutes. This pup's mucous membranes, the gums, was rather bluish. It was very weak. It was not responsive. We could just tell this kid was fading and fading fast.
Yeah.
So it was epinephrine, same type of things we use for cardiac issues and some intravenous fluids and some steroids. And just within minutes of getting this and some oxygen, the kid started looking so much better, watched through the rest of the day, and then said, here's your prescription for an EpiPen. And anyone who has a friend, a family member who has allergies, for instance, to bees, may be carrying around in their purse, in their pocket, a self-injector. Said, this is what you need for this pet. If it happens again, you may not survive.
I've not had a lot of experience with those, but I have, I guess, seen more of those recently. I don't know whether it's just the types of cases that are in this area, you know, the number of stinging insects or something like that. But I think that's probably a good idea in the example of the pet with the extreme reaction. It probably isn't for the pet who has the more run-of-the-mill reaction of the hive sort of thing, but I think that's probably a good idea. And then you'd also worry that, well, could this pet also have more hypersensitivity to other things? If he's that sensitive to, you know, insect venom, could there be other? So, you know, calling upon a dermatologist even, or maybe something to do as well, and see if there's other things that we need to worry about. But I think that's a good idea to have those EpiPens.
Well, Dr. Walters has some good ideas. Our next good idea is going to be listening to the short break we have, commercial. We'll be right back to talk more to Dr. Walters about preventive care, emergency care. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hey, Introducing the new Brett Michaels Pets Rock Collection, exclusively at PetSmart. I created it for the pets that rock your world.
Shop the Brett Michaels Pets Rock Collection and celebrate PetSmart's 25th anniversary with up to 25% off thousands of items on the PetSmart site. Plus free shipping on orders of $49 or more. Go to PetSmartDeal.com. That's PetSmartDeal.com. PetSmartDeal.com.
Dyson.
The new Dyson Animal Vacs are powerful bagless upright vacuums for homes with pets. Air muscle and radial root cyclone technology generates the strongest suction power to powerfully remove dust, dirt, and pet hair from the home or car. To order your Dyson Animal Vac, go to DysonDeals.com. DysonDeals.com to order your Dyson Animal Vac today.
Dyson, music to your ears.
Love your pets but wish their medications were a lot less expensive? They are at 1-800-PetMeds. You'll not only save on flea and heartworm medications, but on prescriptions for arthritis, incontinence, thyroid, and more. And you get fast service, free shipping, and a 100% satisfaction guarantee. Plus, our licensed pharmacists ensure accuracy, monitor drug interaction, and more. See why over 5 million people have trusted their pet's health to 1-800-PetMeds, America's largest pet pharmacy. Call now or order online.
Go to PetMeds.com/doctor, D-O-C-T-O-R, to get 10% off any order and free shipping on orders of $39 or more at PetMeds.com.
Your groomer is going to hate me. Hi, I'm Allie McLennan. Join me for my Pet Life radio show, Groom for Improvement. You're going to save time and money with these tips from my New York City grooming table. From product recommendations to do's and don'ts, I am going to hook you up. So just do me a favor and don't mention this to your groomer. Groom for Improvement on Pet Life Radio.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Walters, this has just been some really good information that people can be aware of at home, emergency situations that their pets can get into. So right now being summer, some of the other problems, there's lakes, there's ocean where we are here in Southern California, drowning. Talk a little bit about what you can see. Now, not all dogs are able to swim. You're talking about having a Frenchie. How does your Frenchie swim?
He doesn't swim very well. He's a trim little dog with not a lot of body fat. So if he doesn't keep moving, he sinks. And, you know, truth be known, he probably is not the most, swimming isn't his biggest thing.
Not his forte. Really, all right.
Not his forte, exactly. Unlike, you know, the other dogs that we have who really love water. So I think that if owners, and we all like to get our dogs out and have them, you know, interact with us at, you know, the lakes, the ocean, you know, those types of things. Again, it takes, just like with a young child, you have to kind of introduce your pets to this in a little bit more of a safe environment. So I wouldn't take the novice swimmer out to, you know, the ocean with pounding surf to try to get them to learn how to swim. I think it needs to be something that's a little bit more sedate, you know, so maybe it's, you know, a small pond or something like that, and just sort of get their feet wet, so to speak. I think that's a good idea. But you just have to be, you know, mindful that swimming's not every dog's, you know, forte. It's not their bag. So if they don't really like it that much, I wouldn't really force the issue. Some dogs are just, you know, born for the water. Labradors, Goldens, etc. You can't hardly.
And even dogs that are born for it can still get tired. My black lab, yeah. I had him, and as a pup, didn't really like water. Got him used to getting in water through using one of those kiddie pools. So he'd just kind of jump in, going for his ball, and got it to the point where you couldn't keep him out of water. But then started noticing as he got older, because, of course, he always had to swim with a ball in his mouth. And his little buns would go further and further down in the water, and he started sinking. It's like he needed a life preserver. So yeah. I do recommend that if you're going to be on a boat near a lake, you have your pet. Just like if you're going to have a small child or sometimes even an adult who can't swim, get a life preserver. That can save their life. And if you have a pool, make sure they know how to get out of the pool.
Yeah. Again, it's just, I think, like a child in many ways, that, you know, you're going to make sure that that child knows how you know, the sort of the rules of the road around the pool, you know, making sure that there's supervision, not that they're unattended. We see a few, you know, sort of accidents where the dog has this free access to a pool and ends up getting into some problems. And as you described, maybe the dog is getting fatigued, or maybe they're just getting older, and we're not, again, aware that they've lost some of their condition to where they can tolerate that same level of activity, having difficulties getting out of the pool where previously they just bound out of it. It just takes our awareness to understand the pet's limits and making sure that we're kind of controlling that situation as best possible.
You're talking, Dr. Walters, about you may have that worst case scenario. The dog has access to the pool or it's in a lake and all of a sudden it drowns. And if you were to see a child, oh my goodness, who was on the bottom of the pool, you get the child out, you try to do mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. I know you can do it to a pet. If you could describe how you would do a mouth-to-mouth on a pet.
So in most cases, it's going to be mouth-to-snout. So you're going to have to, with the longer-nosed dogs, close their mouth and breathe through their nose. Probably first, you're going to want to try to get as much of, if they actually have drowned or inhaled water, try to get as much of that water out of their airway as possible. So maybe even holding them with their head down to allow some gravity to allow that water to drain. And then start with breathing through their snout, you know, taking deep breaths in your mouth, into your lungs, and then blowing into their snout with their mouth closed. The rules of CPR have kind of changed recently, and that's essentially what you're starting. And so now we concentrate on compressions, airway breathing, rather than the ABCs. It's now the CABs. And so with that sort of initial sort of action, if we're not seeing a return to spontaneous breathing very quickly, then you're going to have to get on the road and find a veterinarian very quickly, because the chances of that pet surviving are going down very rapidly.
Translate the CAB.
CABs are compressions, airway, and breathing. Rather than the previous ABCs that we as veterinarians are used to hearing about, where it's airway, breathing, circulation, those are your priorities of some arrest situations. Now we've kind of switched it a little bit to where we're concentrating in CPR on compressions first and then establishing airway and breathing. Reasons being is that in a normal healthy dog, cat, the tension or the amount of oxygen in the bloodstream actually remains fairly high for a fairly long period of time. So us sort of taking the time to establish airways and, you know, checking breathing and things like that we can do in a hospital environment can actually delay getting the all-important compressions on the heart to try to reestablish that active heartbeat and recirculate blood. That's the important part, is trying to recirculate blood to particularly the brain and the heart and keeping those organs alive. So there's been recent switches in human medicine that we've borrowed and now are reestablishing our own sort of guidelines for CPR. And one of those guidelines, part of it is this concentration on compressions, airway breathing, rather than airway breathing compressions.
What is the rate of compression for, say, a cat, small dog, medium-sized dog, large-sized dog?
So the compressions pretty much stay the same across all species, all types. The rates vary between 80 and 110, 100 beats per minute. And then the breathing is very similar to the previous sort of guidelines, where you're breathing ideally at a simultaneous time as the compressions are ongoing, even though, and you're trying to, of course, you know, coordinate that effort. And this is really more of in a hospital environment. Out in the field, so to speak, the first responder would be the owner. And so in those cases, you know, they can still concentrate on compressions, approximately 80 beat compressions per minute, as a starting place with breathing through mouth to snout, and may have some success in reestablishing, you know, a spontaneous beat and spontaneous breathing.
And the sad part is, even in a hospital setting, you don't always bring them back. So people at home, a pet owner, at least knows they tried, and if it doesn't work, at least they tried. I think one of the most important things is, you know, trying to describe right now in the air where to do the compression. I find when they're laying on their right-hand side, and if you were to take their front arm, bend their elbow so the upper portion of the arm is parallel to the spine, where that point of the elbow touches the side of the chest, is typically where you're going to do your compressions. and all of this sounds good, but gee, how do I know how to do this in the middle of an emergency? The American Red Cross, and there's other companies too, organizations that put on pet first aid courses. I think it's an awesome thing for all parents of children should do this. All parents of pets should take a first aid course, because when you need it, you want to just be able to do it and not think about it and try to find the book.
Yeah, exactly. It can't be something of, you know, well, where is the manual? Start learning how to do this. And during the heat of the moment, you have to be able to apply it pretty quickly. So I agree. I think parents need to know that, and pet owners need to know that. I think that would be ideal. You know, again, the description of that, your hand placement is accurate. It's, you know, it's just a matter of trying. Probably the first thing to do is just, you know, try to avoid the arrest in every situation as you can. So being, again, aware of what's going on in your environment, and, you know, is my dog getting fatigued? Can they swim really well? Are they getting into a problem? You know, those types of things. Just like we look at patients in the hospital, trying to avoid the arrest is probably the first thing that we do. But sometimes it can't be avoided. And you're right. There's many, many cases, unfortunately. The survival rate is extremely poor. Even with proper training in the most ideal situations, it's still very poor.
Well, on a happy note is it's summer and you want to travel, and oftentimes people taking their pets along. Tell us some of the problems you've seen with pets that present to you for travel-related emergencies.
So, again, unfortunately, we still kind of see a lot of overheating where, you know, you're traveling with your dog and you leave it in the car because you're taking a break and you're going to lunch or what have you, and those cars are just little ovens. Even if, again, the temperature is fairly mild and you're thinking, oh, this is really comfortable, you know, the sun is beating down on that car and it can easily overheat the interior.
Crack the window, you're in the shade, it's still hot.
Yeah, it's still hot. 70-degree weather with a car in the sun can easily get the interior temperature, you know, well into the hundreds very quickly. And again, our pets don't have the ability to perspire. They certainly don't have the ability to get themselves out of that environment once they're locked into the car. So that's an unfortunate and still very common sort of emergency that we see. And then I would imagine there's still sort of the same GI upsets that we see, because, you know, there's foods and there's treats and they're going on a trip and everybody's got, you know, different things and it's a fun time and the dogs aren't used to those things. And so, you know, GI upset, vomiting, diarrhea, very common. A fair number of injuries, I guess. We see, you know, the dog who's new to some environment, they're going to visit relatives or friends and isn't aware of what's going on in their new area, and they, you know, they have some sort of injury, whether it's something very catastrophic and serious like being, you know, hit by a car, or, you know, just them not really paying attention where they're running and they, you know, run into something that causes them some injury. So we see a fair number of injuries or stepping on things. You know, the cuts and the lacerations are also fairly common. But all the things that we've talked about as far as awareness of the environment is what we need to do as pet owners, is just be aware of what we're putting our dogs and cats into so that we can avoid things rather than being proactive rather than reactive.
I tend to be the Girl Scout, yes, of being the proactive of, I travel and, you know, I have the first aid kit for me, and believe that people, when they travel with their pets, you can take your people first aid kit, add things to it to make it more pet friendly, so you can have that extra leash. You can even carry a pillowcase to pop that small dog or cat into in case you needed to get it out of a situation, carrying a picture of your pet. So in case it does escape, you can go, oh yes, I have a black lab. Well, what does it look like? I don't know, it's a black lab. So here you have a picture of that, you know, pet. That's a good idea. And one of the things I love, even if your pet's not traveling, is to make sure that it has a microchip in place, because that totally indoor pet, earthquakes, fires, floods, whatever happens, and now that indoor pet's an outdoor pet, it has no way even to have its collar. Collar can come off. Now you have a way of getting that pet back to you, and pet insurance. I think pet insurance is good. You being an emergency veterinarian, what have you seen with people saying, pet insurance? They like it, they don't like it?
I think overall they like it. I know that from my experience, pet insurance has helped owners sort of afford some of the more serious things that we sometimes see. I do see quite a few clients with pet insurance, and so I think it's certainly becoming a lot more common. And there seems to be, at least my experience, a lot of companies out there. I don't know the advantages and disadvantages to each of those companies and policies. I think that's where, you know, the consumer needs to do their own education and figure out what the best policy might be. I think it's becoming a lot more common. People still are taking care of it primarily, and I think that's the majority of our owners will still take care of their pets' bills primarily, but there is a, seems to be a growing percentage of pet owners that have pet insurance. I know I fill out, you know, the little forms on a fairly regular basis. And fortunately, from a veterinary standpoint, the forms are not as, you know, egregious as the human forms and things like that as far as claims are concerned. It's very easy for us to fill it out, and then the owners take care of it from there. So it's, I think it's a useful thing.
I think it's a great idea, and I strongly recommend it. I agree with you. There's so many different companies that are out there. Going to the internet, doing your due diligence, finding out what meets your needs, what you can afford, and then hopefully you'll never need it. So I have earthquake insurance because I live here in Southern California, but if the earthquake happens, it's going to be too late for me to get it, you know, afterwards. So yes.
Exactly. I think I agree with you. I think that for those pet owners who feel like, gosh, I really want to have this, they really need to do their education and figure out what's the best policy, what can I afford, you know, do I just want a catastrophic policy? I know there's policies out there that will cover well animals as well, and maybe even look at the different sort of subsections within those policies, because, you know, there may be, you know, limited funds for certain types of emergencies sometimes, or certain type of procedures. Not that you can anticipate that, but just be aware of what that policy is providing you.
One thing people may want to go to, there's a website, 1-800-PET-INSURANCE, and it helps you compare and contrast various policies. So I think you've compared and contrasted some great ways that people can prevent coming to see, nothing personal, someone such as yourself, a criticalist, or even me, that's all right. They're just coming in for well babies and take care of other problems. Dr. Walters, you've given us some great information today. I really do appreciate it.
And I appreciate you inviting me on, and thank you very much. And it was a great time.
Great, thank you. Everyone, please tune in again next week to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. We'll have more information on how to make you the best pet owner you can be. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.